News Talk on demand. Interruption-free audio. Where you want it, when you want it.
Your Liberal Party took $500,000 of illegal donations when you were the head of that party. The average trucker has more integrity in his pinky finger than you had in your entire scandal-plagued Liberal cabinet.
Mr. Poilievre, during that period, supported an illegal blockade. You cannot make laws and break laws and then say, I will make laws for other people.
And here we are, calling each other names. What Canadian is going to trust this lot? We've got to do better.
Last week's debate among the Conservative leadership frontrunners at that Conservative conference going on in Ottawa, and we chatted with Brian Lilly, we talked with others who said they didn't really like the feel of the thing. But an interesting piece written, Brian Lee Crowley, who we've chatted with before many times, founder and managing director of the McDonnell Laurier Institute. I was here a few weeks ago chatting about the Brad Wall genius in Saskatchewan, and he talked about the entire idea of populism in politics. Well, Brian and his group have put together a collection of essays at the McDonnell Laurier Institute called A Modern Conservatism for a Modern Canada. And there's a lot of talk in this leadership convention where come September, the Conservatives will choose a new leader. And at this point, it looks like it will be Pierre Poilievre or Jean Charest. It's a time for Conservatives to look at what does the state of conservatism look like in Canada. Now, I've tipped my hand. I'm one who is ready to try populism in its more refined, not an intolerant, crazy populism, but a lot of things Poilievre is saying, I think Canada's overdue for. We have Brian Lee Crowley in Ottawa this morning. Always good to have you back, my friend. Thank you for joining us.
John, it's always a pleasure to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
And walk me through, if you would, some of the considerations when you try to look for what a modern conservatism will look like in a modern Canada.
Well, you know, one of the things that I talk about is the extent to which, you know, I don't think the average person in Canada spends a lot of time thinking about politics. You know, they've got their own lives to get on with, their own concerns. They're worried about their family. They're worried about their job. They're worried about their community, national politics. You know, I'm not saying they don't care, but it's a small concern amongst their daily preoccupations. And, of course, we also know that people tend to discount what politicians say. I wonder why that might be. It might be because they don't always tell the truth. Or, you know, they say, I'm going to do X, Y, Z, and then conditions don't allow it or whatever. So, you know, people aren't that concerned about politics. They don't know all that much about whether they can believe politicians' promises. But I think they're really good at sussing out the emotional temperature and disposition of leaders of parties. And I the thing that's worrying me about what I'm seeing in the Conservative leadership campaign is that I see a lot of anger. And a lot of that anger is completely justified. I think people are upset about the direction the country is headed in. But I don't think that anger is enough to convince people to vote for a Conservative party. You need to have a positive program that grows out of anger, that grows out of populism, that appeals to people who aren't already angry. And I think that's where, so far, I'm not seeing the leadership campaigns of the various candidates connecting with Canadians.
It's a great point, because it's often observed, and, you know, a good example was the last two elections where people said, well, you should just lay out Mr. Trudeau's litany of sins. Surely no one will vote for that. And it's attractive and easy when you're thinking of making a campaign of, you know, highlighting the negatives of your opponent. No one, sometimes you need to do that, but at the same time, no one will ever vote for somebody who doesn't give them an alternative or put a candle in the window.
Yep, I think this is really key for the Conservatives to take on board. It's not enough to say, you know, the government of the day is doing a terrible job, because you have to convince people that there's at least a good chance you do a better job. Otherwise, you know, the fact of the matter is people are going to stick with the devil they know, because at least, you know, they know how this government will behave. If you want to displace them, you have to give people a sense that you've got the emotional predisposition, the kind of character that says, you know, I will use power in a way that will make you, if not proud of this country, at least reasonably happy about the direction we're going in. And, you know, connecting with voters on that kind of emotional level is a very subtle and complicated thing. And I'm hearing lots of candidates getting out there and saying, you know, well, you know, I'm angry about taxes, or I'm angry about the CBC, or I'm angry about this, I'm angry about that. And you are too. So I'm your guy. It's not enough. It's not enough.
And you can take those issues, taxes, CBC, and other things, and I would assume turn it into a positive-looking, constructive, here's what I'll do and why kind of approach, because the circumstances and the nation warrant this and that.
Yeah, you know, look, I'm not a candidate for the leadership of the Conservative Party, but I was on a panel the other day, and the question that was put to the panel was, you know, what's the one thing you would say to the Conservative leadership candidates that they you know, the thing that they really need to talk about, that they really need to bring to the table? And I said, well, you know, from my point of view, I think it's that Canadians love Canada. Canadians are proud of Canada. We're a country where like a quarter of the population was born in another country and moved here. They had a choice. Any, you know, if they're leaving their home country, they can go anywhere in the world. And they choose Canada. And this is one of the highest proportions of, you know, people born in another country of any country in the world. So, you know, and they come here because of the strengths of Canadian society, because, you know, we're free and we're prosperous and we're respectful of each other. And, you know, I think that the government of the day is not reflecting that back at Canadians at all. In fact, you know, it seems to me the government of the day has nothing but bad things to say about Canadians. You know, we seem to be genocidal, white supremacist, misogynistic crazies. And the only reason that Canada isn't some kind of hellhole is because the government is there to protect us from ourselves. I don't think that's the way Canadians feel about Canada at all. And yet I think they're letting the government get away with that. And nobody is standing up and saying, you know, I'm here to restore the love and respect that Canadians feel for Canada. I think this would be a powerful message for a lot of Canadians and make them say, yeah, I feel good about Canada. Why do I keep hearing all these terrible things from people in Ottawa about the country I live in? Because it just doesn't reflect the feelings of Canadians about Canada.
Brian Crowley, Managing Director, Founder, McDonald Laurier Institute. Last question. A lot of conservatives, particularly, again, as you say, in that ebb and flow of, you know, what passes for political dialogue, conservatives don't care about the poor, the weak, the vulnerable, and conservatives are all about taking away abortion rights and reproductive rights from women. I mean, it really distills in a lot of the liberal talking points to those are the two things conservatives are.
Yeah, well, you know, you never want to let your political opponents define who you are.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that I say in my collection of essays that you referred to at the beginning is I said, you know, the Canadian Conservatives have the same problem that the British Conservatives had. The British Conservatives were known as the mean party. Right. Like these are the people who want to hurt and take away the benefits of the poor, the vulnerable and so on. And the argument that I made in the essays is that, you know, one of the ways that I think conservatives can combat that in Canada is by embracing an agenda of reconciliation with Indigenous people. I think this is something that Canadians have strong feelings about, that they, you know, there's an awareness that we have not done right by Indigenous people. And, you know, a Conservative Party that got beyond the sort of, you know, symbolism of the current government and actually started, you know, building reconciliation on the ground, working with Indigenous people to develop the natural resource economy, creating opportunities, integrating them into the institutions that have served other Canadians so well and that Indigenous people were excluded from, quite wrongly. Now we have a chance to do something about that. And I think that if they were to embrace that as a key part of their message, I think it would help to combat that that notion that their opponents like to put about, that they're somebody who, you know, just doesn't care about the weak and the vulnerable. And, you know, it's all about cutting taxes and cutting programs and devil take the hindmost. I think they need to speak to that concern directly. And reconciliation with Indigenous people offers a perfect opportunity to do that.
Thanks so much for this. If people want to have a look at Modern Conservatism for a Modern Canada, we can find the collection of essays.
Yes, it's on our website, www.macdonaldlaurier.ca. And, you know, it covers a whole range of issues that are, some of which are being talked about in the Tory leadership campaign and some of which aren't.
Always good. Take care and we'll chat soon.
I'll look forward to it, John. Thanks so much.
Brian Crowley in the nation's capital, founder, managing director of the Macdonald Laurier Institute. And the collection of essays, I mean, here's just a quick heading on the chapters. Why gratitude, not ideology, is the trademark of real conservatism. Country before ideology. Conservatives need to take responsibilities to Canadians seriously. A jobs, growth, and opportunity agenda. Cold War Mark II isn't coming, and how will conservatives respond? Conservatives, you don't need to take leave of your senses to take climate change seriously. Reconciling a growth and opportunity agenda with overdue welcoming of legitimate Indigenous power and self-determination. If conservatives think Canada is irretrievably left-wing, Saskatchewan should make you think again. And that was the piece we talked about with him a couple of weeks ago. What conservatives might learn from COVID and the failures of progressivism. And the rule of law is a conservative issue, but it cannot apply only to its party's political opponents. Those are a few of his thoughts, and all very evocative thoughts. Some provocative, but if it's Brian, it's always going to evoke thought from you. Thoughts. Lots of things on the go here today we're going to talk about, including some of the things that arose the last hour. 877-332-8255. That's the text number. It also gets you onto our listener line for chatting. I'm John Gormley on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. I'm John Gormley. Kevin, one of our gang on Twitter, says no conservative candidate is saying they're angry. His point is that's what the observers say about the conservative candidates. No candidate is expressing that anger. And besides, taking climate change seriously is ceding the ground to crazy people. You know, I agree with you, but it all frames what is seriously. And we were talking about the heading of one of Brian Lee Crowley's pieces. You don't have to take leave of your senses to take climate change seriously. And you do have to take leave of your senses if you think paying a carbon tax to change the weather is sound policy. It's not. It's crazy. It's silly. If there are things you can do at an industrial level and at a macro level to reduce carbon dioxide and methane emissions while still having thermal energy and the physics to keep power going, why not do it? And that would be a good example. Why wouldn't you go all in nuke? I mean, if you want base load power, expensive at the outside, the capital cost, although small modular reactors are far less expensive, so your upfront capital cost is a little higher. It's like a hydro dam. You know, you build a hydro dam, that's billions of dollars. Then, of course, as you continue to generate day and night, as the water flows through that dam, your unit cost, the longer you're generating it, is cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And that's the way nuclear is. You see incredible savings down the road with nuke. But somebody has to be brave enough to say, okay, here's the quid pro quo. We'll ultimately move power in this country to zero emissions, but we're going to go all in nuke. Now, does that mean we're going to fuel the missiles that will end the planet like we were going on in the 70s? Nope. Does it mean spent fuel rods with a half-life of 300,000 years will poison us for generations? No, we have ways we can deal with that. So it's a good point, though. So I agree with you, Kevin, insofar as if you concede, even using the language climate crisis, if you say climate crisis, you've tipped your hand. And I think you've tipped your hand to being an alarmist and an extremist and somebody whose science is going to tell you isn't making much sense. Longer curve, I think you can do some things with carbon dioxide. So that's kind of where I fit in on this. 877-332-8255. So we were just chatting with Brian Lee Crowley on how he sees the conservative leadership shaping up. I was suggesting, and we'll go with some calls. I was having an interesting thought on the NDP leadership race. We have not yet made a formal reach out. We've been trying to pin down Carla Beck's people. They're just not getting back to us, but I'm sure they will. She's the front runner, I think you can objectively say, in this NDP leadership race. She's a sitting MLA. Caitlin Harvey is new to politics, Saskatoon lawyer. They've only got the two candidates. But I'm kind of interested because I have a bit of a history with NDP leaders. Like Roy Romano and I were always very civil, but in the very dying days of the Romano government, the coalition from 99 to 03, he never said boo to me. Wouldn't come on the show, wouldn't do anything, because we had a lot of fun at the expense of his government, teaming up with the Liberals. Lorne Calvert came in. Early days, we had Premier Calvert on all the time. The last year he governed, crickets. Wouldn't come anywhere near the show. And then there was Dwayne Lingenfelter. I don't know what I ever said to him, but...
But John is lying, and he's disingenuous. And John Gormley is the kind of individual who is ingenuous about these kind of issues. None of what he said in there is true.
So he had problems. I made him so angry he didn't know the difference between ingenuous and disingenuous. But, you know, so... But then it got a little better. Cam Broughton was on with me all the time. Never said a bad word. Ryan Miley was too. It was just you Ryan Miley didn't like.
Angry Gormley listener.
You know, so I'm always keeping an eye out for what happens in NDP leadership politics. This is 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Good to have you here. Lots on the go today. We were just chatting a few minutes ago with Brian Crowley, who heads up the McDonald Laurier Institute, talking about the nature of conservatism in Canada. And Crowley was going down this idea of the perception of Canada, and he made a very good point, and it played right into, and we've got lots of calls coming up on this as well. There's a brand new book out, and I'm trying to find Lydia Perovic. Her book is called Lost in Canada, An Immigrant's Second Thoughts. And she came from the Balkans. She's from Montenegro originally. And she came here in the 90s to go to grad school. And you remember the Balkans War. The Balkans were collapsing after Yugoslavia collapsed. And she talks about the Canada she came to. And then she talks about the Canada we live in today. And from the mid-90s to today, as someone not born here, one in four people who live in this country were not born here, she says there is a big difference. This is not the same Canada. And it's got to do with culture. It's got to do with socially how in the civic square, how we talk about Canada and one another. And it's a very thought-provoking book. I'll give you a quick couple of highlights of a piece that she excerpted from the book. And we're going to get her on, I hope, in a couple of days to talk about this, because something is happening. And it's, I thought it was just me. And I remember the Jean Chrétien years well. I quite liked Paul Martin. I thought he was a delightful man who took the Liberal Party over at a really tough time. I never thought Stephen Harper would become prime minister. Yeah, I just didn't think, it was just something about him. He just wasn't warm enough, cuddly enough. He became prime minister, and I thought he did a magnificent job. I have known prime ministers, spent some time one-on-one with Paul Martin, quite a good day with him. I spent 4 years with Brian Mulroney. So there's a measure of the people who govern us. So I thought it was my frustration at the present prime minister. And there's a lot to be frustrated about. But in many ways, he is the manifestation of how Canadians see Canada. So when Brian Lee Crowley said, this is a country, ask those 1 in 4 people not born here, about love of nation, love of symbols, not a nation of white colonialists, identity politics, bigots, misogynists. And this is really very real. This is the way we talk about Canada. And if you have no cohesion and nothing that holds you together as a common identity, and then put on top of it how we in Western Canada feel, the Canada I fell in love with is gone, is what Lydia Perovic writes in her book, Lost in Canada. So I'm going to get into that in a minute. But your calls in the meantime. James in Saskatoon, you're talking about how conservatives see themselves. Now, you are clearly... a lot of our listeners are Pierre Poilievre people, some Leslin Lewis. You're clearly seeing Jean Charest as what it's going to take to get the conservatives out of the wilderness.
Correct.
Okay.
I think your intro was pretty interesting, because it really did start me to think a little bit harder about strong progressive conservative governments, as you say, like Brian Mulroney or even John Diefenbaker, right? Where they championed the people. They championed, it was a pan-Canadian point of view. It wasn't only a Western Canadian reference, but to what Brian Lee did mention about us is our efforts to work with Indigenous people. You know, I'll never forget, my uncle happened to be elected with John Diefenbaker in 57 and stayed there till 84. And so...
Who's your uncle?
My uncle was Stan Kuczynski.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, great MP. I didn't realize that. Okay.
So anyways, the one thing that I'll still never forget is, even as a young boy, I remember being on reserve one time, and the respect that my uncle received because Diefenbaker's government gave Indigenous people the right to vote. And even years later, it was such a respected point of view that conservatives had that fondness to offer that. And so over the years, we've kind of lost that element. And I think that, and to be sure, I am a Jean Charest supporter, because I see him getting us to the promised land, and that is government, right? We can be as mad as we want to be, but it doesn't solve the problem. And so I think what a Jean Charest government can do is actually usher in a new Canada that, for example, deals better with health care. It's through his capacity to deal and to manage, if you will, and build expectations and to build bridges across party boundaries and provincial boundaries, to get us to a better process of healthcare, because we've seen in the last little while, we've been pouring more and more money every year in provincial budgets to healthcare. And is it paying us better dividends? I don't think so. So we got to try something better. And I know a strong progressive conservative or a conservative government can do that, John. I truly have the utmost of confidence that a Jean Charest progressive or conservative government could do that.
But so you keep stumbling over progressive. I mean, the
yes,
party's called
nature.
The Conservative Party, and he is a progressive conservative, which is a distinction, I think, right? He's a nice guy, very skilled at governance, but it's going to be fascinating to see what conservatives come out of this thing, you know, having defined themselves as, James, and it's a good point. Appreciate your call. 877-332-8255. Okay, so Lydia Perovic, "The Canada I Fell in Love With Is Gone." And this is an excerpt from Lost in Canada, An Immigrant's Second Thoughts. So I said the mid-90s. The late 90s. She emigrated from Montenegro. And Montenegro is one of the Balkan countries. If you can name them, I think you can. If you can tell me where they are on a map, you're way better than me. I'm all over Croatia. I know where that is. Croatia's beautiful, right along the coast, right across from Italy. Get to Split sometime. Get to Dubrovnik. Croatia's a fabulous country. But, okay, so long story short, she comes from Montenegro. "I used to have it. I've been saying we easily for two decades. I moved here from the wars of the Western Balkans as a grad student to escape the relentless history of home, in search of a functioning draft of a liberal democracy. Here, to a country that doesn't quite gel." And then she talks about how, you know, what she left. "Here was a country interrupted with enormous empty spaces, and none of it seems to disturb it much. Mutual differences are vast. We'd rather not overanalyze what they mean. We live blandness behind an uneventful competence in government. Fundamentally a red Tory political instinct, meaning easy does it, conformist, communitarian. Fair play as an agreed upon ideal. And very little history." Because you, when you come from Eastern and Central Europe, your history goes back. You know, and she talks about how all the borders shifted, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Napoleonic France, the Ottoman Empire. "Something is happening with the we. I'm beginning to suspect there are fewer and fewer of us who believe in the great solidarity across ethnicity, class, and time. My adopted country of Canada and my city," she's in Toronto, "are becoming unrecognizable. Conversations in the public sphere are changing, as are the conversations in the media and the culture. Public speech is increasingly now premised with a recitation of pronouns. And this is even how lawyers in BC courts and their clients have to conduct themselves in hearings. And land acknowledgements, whose treaty, whose land. What should those who do not share those religious and ideological beliefs do? Are we always already letting the side down before we haven't even said anything yet? The internet speaks American, and so increasingly do we, importing wholesale the culture wars as they're happening in the U.S., adopting the diagnoses of American problems as universally relevant. There's this elaborate vocabulary of political contestation all around us, so I guess why not use it? The thinking goes, we apply the American framework of irreconcilable black and white differences to Canada to help harden the settler and indigenous split. Where this paradigm's not available, we can always choose white and BIPOC, that strangely unifying acronym of black, indigenous, people of color, as if they all have something in common, as if not being white automatically puts them in the same category. In the past 5 years in particular, people running Canadian cultural institutions and media have put, and I love this line, all of their chips on irreconcilable differences. There's no Canada for all, no political cause for all, no arts for all. There is no individual outside of ethnic determinism. There are bits and bobs of interregional or interethnic resentment. But what happens to class analysis under those circumstances? And she goes on to basically say, we've become a country that puts all of our chips on irreconcilable differences between us. And that's really very much like Brian Lee Crowley had said. Canadians increasingly are being asked to regard one another as settlers, colonialists, racists. And that's not Canada. And first of all, that's not objectively who we are. I mean, there are people who you're going to object to, but Canada's a country that used to have a sense of what pulled us together. Not so much anymore. Now, the Prime Minister plays into that. You know, I've never seen a human being who can milk identity politics like he does. And if he were not a prime minister, he would be just some very woke trust fund grown-up child who's annoying at dinner parties. But he's the prime minister of Canada, and he's been here now three terms. So obviously his view of Canada and this idea that we all fit into boxes and the boxes are at some kind of conflict with some ideal or with one another, that's Canada today. So I'm going to find Lydia Perovic's book, and we'll try to find her too in the coming days. I'm John Gormley. This is 650 CKOM and 980 CJME. Conservative politics. Norm says, I was willing to give the conservatives one more chance, but after hearing Pierre Poilievre in that debate, I actually think Jean Charest is the best option. Weird, eh? My thoughts, if we elect another Quebecer, is there a better chance for genuine Western autonomy to move forward? Go, Jean, go. Rick in Saskatoon, conservatives could responsibly defund the CBC and split the budget of money that's been used to fund this broadcaster between clean water on First Nations communities for every First Nations community and the military. It's a win-win for conservative votes. Sandra in Kelvington, all of the mainstream parties are going to have to cater to the Laurentian Triangle, Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto. Votes from Manitoba to the West Coast don't even count. Dean and Estevan, if Pierre Poilievre wins the conservative leadership, I think he will be what this country needs, and especially the West. It'll make every fringe conservative party irrelevant, and he will win the West in a landslide. Those are a few of your thoughts on the future of conservatives and politically the party. Lots of talk this morning, and all morning long you've been texting on our very first guest, who was Naomi Hunter, leader of the Saskatchewan Green Party, takes the position that Saskatchewan should completely abandon any kind of nuclear power generation with small modular reactors. She says microgrids where windmills and solar and geothermal will be able to provide enough power, according to her. Barry in Saskatoon, I've been in the electrical delivery system my entire life. It sounds really nice to have 400 megawatts of wind generation in a 4,000 megawatt system. However, it doesn't always blow and give you all of that. Oftentimes, it will be as low as 5 to 10%. Scott says, the comparison to Iceland and geothermal, it works well there because the heat is so much closer to the surface. I would love to see a study if large-scale geothermal is viable here. But in the meantime, I'm all for small modular reactors. How about build a test facility for both? They could even be done at the same site as both generate power in a similar manner. Jim, when Naomi Hunter was talking about farms doing stuff the old way, she failed to mention old wooden cook stoves for heating and cooking. So windmills and burning wood? She says she's living off the grid. I have doubts about how off the grid this idea actually is. Jeff in Regina, what I heard today was the problem with the Green Party in general. They complain about having no alternatives and then offer no viable alternatives. Craig in Regina, climate change alarmists who want to go back to horse and buggy days and Saskatchewan of the 1930s? Nope. Richard in Regina, I visit many farmers. If wind was a good and viable idea, every farm would have a turbine. Everyone I speak to says wind is unreliable as well as being expensive. David Musselman, I find it ironic that the Green Party and Naomi Hunter said nuclear is too far off and we need immediate solutions. It is the green ideas like this, along with the alarmism, that has delayed moving on better power projects. So perhaps assume some of the blame for the climate crisis yourself. And these solutions are pipe dreams. A few of your thoughts in a very busy morning here. Coming up, Danny Savalas is going to be with us, NBC legal analyst, watching closely the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial. And what a trial it is. Next on 650 CKOM and 980 CJME.